Unit 13. Text 1. Euphemism by Neil Postman. Text. A euphemism is commonly defined as an auspicious or exalted term, like sanitation engineer, that is used in place of a more down-to-earth term, like garbage man. People who are partial to euphemisms stand accused of being phony or trying to hide what it is they are really talking about. And there's no doubt that in some situations, the accusation is entirely proper. For example, one of the more detestable euphemisms I have come across in recent years is the term Operation Sunshine, which is the name the U.S. government gave to some experiments it conducted with a hydrogen bomb in the South Pacific. It is obvious that the government, in choosing this name, was trying to expunge the hideous imagery that the bomb evokes, and in so doing, committed, as I see it, an immoral act. This sort of process, giving pretty names to essentially ugly realities, is what has given euphemizing such a bad name. And people like George Orwell have done valuable work for all of us in calling attention to how the process works. But there is another side to euphemizing that is worth mentioning, and a few words here in its defense will not be amiss. To begin with, we must keep in mind that things do not have real names, although many people believe that they do. A garbage man is not really a garbage man, any more than he is really a sanitation engineer. And a pig is not called a pig because it is so dirty, nor a shrimp because it is so small. There are things, and then there are the names of things. And it is considered a fundamental error in all branches of semantics to assume that a name and a thing are one and the same. It is true, of course, that a name is usually so firmly associated with the thing it denotes that it is extremely difficult to separate one from the other. That is why, for example, advertising is so effective. Perfumes are not given names like Bronx Odor, and an automobile will never be called the Lumbering Elephant. Shakespeare was only half right in saying that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. What we call things affects how we will perceive them. It is not only harder to sell someone a horse mackerel sandwich than a tuna fish sandwich, but even though they are the same thing, we are likely to enjoy the taste of tuna more than that of the horse mackerel. It would appear that human beings almost naturally come to identify names with things, which is one of our most fascinating illusions. But there is some substance to this illusion. For if you change the names of things, you change how people will regard them, and that is as good as changing the nature of the thing itself. Now, all sorts of scoundrels know this perfectly well, and can make us love almost anything by getting us to transfer the charm of a name to whatever worthless thing they are promoting. But at the same time, and in the same vein, euphemizing is a perfectly intelligent method of generating new and useful ways of perceiving things. The man who wants us to call him a sanitation engineer instead of a garbage man is hoping we will treat him with more respect than we presently do. He wants us to see that he is of some importance to our society. His euphemism is laughable only if we think that he is not deserving of such notice of respect. The teacher who prefers us to use the term culturally different children instead of slum children is euphemizing, all right, but is doing it to encourage us to see aspects of a situation that might otherwise not be attended to. The point I am making is that there is nothing in the process of euphemizing itself that is contemptible. Euphemizing is contemptible when a name makes us see something that is not true or diverts our attention from something that is. The hydrogen bomb kills. There is nothing else that it does. And when you experiment with it, you are trying to find out how widely and how well it kills. Therefore, to call such an experiment Operation Sunshine is to suggest a purpose for the bomb that simply does not exist. But to call slum children culturally different is something else. It calls attention, for example, to legitimate reasons why such children might feel alienated from what goes on in school. I grant that sometimes such euphemizing does not have the intended effect. It is possible for a teacher to use the term culturally different, but still be controlled by the term slum children, which the teacher may believe is their real name. Old people may be called senior citizens, and nothing might change. And lunatic asylums may still be filthy, primitive prisons, though they are called mental institutions. Nonetheless, euphemizing may be regarded as one of our more important intellectual resources for creating new perspectives on a subject. The attempt to rename old people, senior citizens, was obviously motivated by a desire to give them a political identity, which they not only warrant, but which may yet have important consequences. In fact, the fate of euphemisms is very hard to predict. A new and seemingly silly name may replace an old one, let us say a chairperson for chairman, and for years no one will think or act any differently because of it. And then gradually, as people begin to assume that chairperson is the real and proper name, or senior citizen, or tuna fish, or sanitation engineer, their attitudes begin to shift, and they will approach things in a slightly different frame of mind. There is a danger, of course, in supposing that a new name can change attitudes quickly or always. There must be some authentic tendency or drift in the culture to lend support to the change, or the name will remain incongruous and may even appear ridiculous. To call a teacher a facilitator would be such an example. To eliminate the distinction between boys and girls by calling them childpersons would be another. But to suppose that such changes never amount to anything is to underestimate the power of names. I have been astounded not only by how rapidly the name blacks has replaced Negroes, a kind of euphemizing in reverse, but also by how significantly perceptions and attitudes have shifted as an accompaniment to the change. The key idea here is that euphemisms are a means through which a culture may alter its imagery and, by so doing, subtly change its style, its priorities, and its values. I reject categorically the idea that people who use earthly language are speaking more directly or with more authenticity than people who employ euphemisms. Saying that someone is dead is not to speak more plainly or honestly than saying he has passed away. It is, rather, to suggest a different conception of what the event means. To ask where the shithouse is no more to the point than to ask where the restroom is. But in the difference between the two words, there is expressed a vast difference in one's attitude toward privacy and propriety. What I am saying is that the process of euphemizing has no moral content. The moral dimensions are supplied by what the words in question express, what they want us to value and to see. A nation that calls experiments with bombs Operation Sunshine is very frightening. On the other hand, a people who call garbage men sanitation engineers can't be all bad.
Text 2. Clutter by William Zinser. Fighting clutter is like fighting weeds. The writer is always slightly behind. New varieties sprout overnight, and by noon they are part of American speech. John Dean holds the record. In just one day of testimony on TV during the Watergate hearings, he raised the clutter quotient by 400%. The next day, everyone in America was saying, at this point in time, instead of now. Consider all the prepositions that are routinely draped onto verbs that don't need any help. Head up, free up, face up to. We no longer head committees. We head them up. We don't face problems anymore. We face up to them when we can free up a few minutes. A small detail, you may say, not worth bothering about. It is worth bothering about. The game is won or lost on hundreds of small details. Writing improves in direct ratio to the number of things we can keep out of it that shouldn't be there. Up in free up shouldn't be there. Can we picture anything being freed up? The writer of Clean English must examine every word that he puts on paper. He will find a surprising number that don't serve any purpose. Take the adjective personal, as in a personal friend of mine, his personal feeling, or her personal physician. It is typical of the words that can be eliminated 9 times out of 10. The personal friend has come into the language to distinguish him from the business friend, thereby debasing not only language but friendship. Someone's feelings is his personal feeling. That's what his means. As for the personal physician, he is that man summoned to the dressing room of a stricken actress so that she won't have to be treated by the impersonal physician assigned to the theatre. Someday I'd like to see him identified as her doctor. Physicians are physicians, friends are friends, the rest is clutter. Clutter is the laborious phrase, which has pushed out the short word that means the same thing. These locutions are a drag on energy and momentum. Even before John Dean gave us at this point in time, people had stopped saying now. They were saying at the present time, or currently, or presently, which means soon. Yet the idea can always be expressed by now to mean the immediate moment. Now I can see him, or by today to mean the historical present. Today prices are high. Or simply by the verb to be. It is raining. There is no need to say, at the present time we are experiencing precipitation. Speaking of which, we are experiencing considerable difficulty getting that word out of the language now that it has been lumbered in. Even your dentist will ask if you are experiencing any pain. If he were asking one of his own children, he would say, "Does it hurt?" He would, in short, be himself. By using more pompous phrase in his professional role, he not only sounds more important, he blunts the painful edge of truth. It is the language of the airline stewardess demonstrating the oxygen mask that will drop down if the plane should somehow run out of air. In the extremely unlikely possibility that the aircraft should experience such an eventuality, she begins, a phrase so oxygen-depriving in itself that we are prepared for any disaster, and even gasping death shall lose its sting. As for her request to kindly extinguish all smoking materials, I often wonder what materials are smoking. Maybe she thinks my coat and tie are on fire. Clutter is a ponderous euphemism that turns a slum into a depressed socio-economic area, a salesman into a marketing representative, and garbage collectors into waste disposal personnel. In New Canaan, Connecticut, the incinerator is now the volume reduction unit. I think of Bill Mauldin's cartoon showing two hobos riding a freight train. One of them says, "I started as a simple bum, but now I'm hardcore unemployed." Clutter is the official language used by the American corporation in its news release and in its annual report to hide its mistakes. When a big company recently announced that it was decentralizing its organizational structure into major profit-centered businesses and that corporate staff services will be realigned under 2 senior vice presidents, it meant that it had had a lousy year. Clutter is the language of the inter-office memo. The trend to mosaic communication is reducing the meaningfulness of concern about whether or not demographic segments differ in their tolerance of periodicity. And the language of computers, congruent command paradigms explicitly represent the semantic oppositions in the definitions of the commands to which they refer. Clutter is the language of the Pentagon, throwing dust in the eyes of the populace by calling an invasion a reinforced protective reaction strike and by justifying its vast budgets on the need for credible second strike capability and counterforce deterrence. How can we grasp such vaporous double talk? As George Orwell pointed out in Politics and the English Language, an essay written in 1946 but cited frequently during the Vietnam and Cambodia years of Johnson and Nixon, In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Orwell's warning that clutter is not just a nuisance but a deadly tool came true in America in the 1960s. In fact, the art of verbal camouflage reached new heights of invention during General Alexander Haig's tenure as Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. Before Haig, nobody had ever thought of saying, "at this juncture of maturization," to mean now. He told the American people that he saw improved pluralization in El Salvador, that terrorism could be fought with meaningful sanctionary teeth, and that intermediate nuclear missiles were at the vortex of cruciality. As for any worries that the public might have about such matters, his message, reduced to one-syllable words, was, "leave it to Al." What he actually said was, "we must push this to a lower decibel of public fixation. I don't think there's much of a learning curve to be achieved in this area of content." I could go on quoting examples from various fields. Every profession has its growing arsenal of jargon to fire at the layman and hurl him back from its walls. But the list would be depressing and the lesson tedious. The point of raising it now is to serve notice that clutter is the enemy, whatever form it takes. It slows the reader and robs the writer of his personality, making him seem pretentious. Beware, then, of the long word that is no better than the short word. Numerous, many. Facilitate, ease. Individual, man or woman. Remainder, rest. Initial, first. Implement, do. Sufficient, enough, attempt, try, refer to as, called, and hundreds more. Beware, too, of all the slippery new fad words for which the language already has equivalents: overview and quantify, paradigm and parameter, infrastructure and interface, private sector and public sector, optimize and maximize, prioritize and potentialize. They are all weeds that will smother what you write. Now, are all the weeds so obvious? Just as insidious are the little growths of perfectly ordinary words with which we explain how we propose to go about our explaining, or which inflate a simple preposition or conjunction into a whole windy phrase. I might add, it should be pointed out, it is interesting to note that how many sentences begin with these dreary clauses announcing what the writer is going to do next? If you might add, add it. If it should be pointed out, point it out. If it is interesting to note, make it interesting. Being told that something is interesting is the surest way of tempting the reader to find it dull. Are we not all stupefied by what follows when someone says, "this will interest you"? As for the inflated prepositions and conjunctions, they are innumerable phrases like, "with the possible exception of," "except," "due to the fact that," "because," "he totally lacked for the ability to," "he couldn't," "until such time as," "until," "for the purpose of," "for." Is there any way to recognize clutter at a glance? Here's a device I used at Yale that students found helpful. I would put brackets around any component in a piece of writing that wasn't doing useful work. Often it was just one word that got bracketed, the unnecessary preposition appended to a verb, "order up," or the adverb that carries the same meaning as the verb, "smile happily," or the adjective that states a known fact, "tall skyscraper." Often my brackets surrounded the little qualifiers that weaken any sentence they inhabit, a bit, sort of the announcements like, "I'm tempted to say." Sometimes my brackets surrounded an entire sentence, the one that essentially repeats what the previous sentence said, or that tells the reader something he doesn't need to know or can figure out for himself. Most people's first drafts can be cut by 50%. They're swollen with words and phrases that do no new work whatever. My reason for bracketing the extra words instead of crossing them out was to avoid violating the sentence. I wanted to leave it intact for the student to analyze. I was saying, "I may be wrong, but I think this can be deleted and the meaning won't be affected at all." But you decide. Read the sentence without the bracketed material and see if it works. In the early weeks of the term, I gave back papers that were infested with brackets. Entire paragraphs were bracketed, but soon the students learned to put mental brackets around their own clutter, and by the end of the term their papers were almost clean. Today, many of those students are professional writers and they tell me, I still see your brackets, they're following me through life. You can develop the same eye. Look for the clutter in your writing and prune it ruthlessly. Be grateful for everything you can throw away. Re-examine each sentence that you put on paper. Is every word doing new work? Can any thought be expressed with more economy? Is anything pompous or pretentious or faddish? Are you hanging on to something useless just because you think it's beautiful? Simplify, simplify.
Listening in and speaking out. Prison Studies by Malcolm X. Many who today hear me somewhere in prison or on television, or those who read something I've said, will think I went to school far beyond the eighth grade. This impression is due entirely to my prison studies. It had really begun back in the Charlestown prison when Bimby first made me feel envy of his stock of knowledge. Bimby had always taken charge of any conversation he was in and had tried to emulate him. But every book I picked up had few sentences which didn't contain anywhere from one to nearly all of the words that might as well have been in Chinese. When I just skipped those words, of course, I really ended up with little idea of what the book said. So I had come to Norfolk Prison Colony still trying to do some book reading. I saw that the best thing I could do was to get hold of a dictionary, to study, to learn some words. I was lucky enough to reason also that I should try to improve my penmanship. It was sad. I couldn't even write in a straight line. It was both ideas together that made me request a dictionary along with some notebooks and pencils from the Norfolk Prison Colony School. I spent 2 days just turning uncertainly over the dictionary's pages. I'd never realized so many words existed. I didn't know which word I needed to learn. Finally, to start some kind of action, I began copying. In my slow, painstaking, ragged handwriting, I copied into my notebook everything printed on that first page, down to the punctuation marks. I believe it took me a day. Then, aloud, I read back to myself everything I'd written in the notebook. Over and over aloud to myself, I read my own handwriting. I woke up the next morning thinking about those words, immensely proud to realize that not only had I written so much at one time, but I'd written words that I never knew were in the world. Moreover, with a little effort, I also could remember what many of these words meant. I reviewed the words whose meanings I didn't remember. I was so fascinated that I went on. I copied the dictionary's next page, and the same experience came when I studied that. With every succeeding page, I also learned of people and places and events from history. Actually, the dictionary is like a miniature encyclopedia. Finally, the dictionary's A section had filled a whole notebook, and I went on into the B's. That was the way I started copying what eventually became the entire dictionary. It went a lot faster after so much practice helped me to pick up handwriting speed. I suppose it was inevitable that as my word base broadened, I could, for the first time, pick up a book and read and now begin to understand what the book was saying. Anyone who has read a great deal can imagine the new world that opened. Let me tell you something. From then until I left that prison, in every free moment I had, if I was not reading in the book, I was reading on my bunk. You couldn't have gotten me out of books at all. I read more in my room than in the library itself. An inmate who was known to read a lot could check out more than the permitted maximum number of books. I preferred reading in the total isolation of my own room. I've often reflected upon the new views that reading opened to me. I knew right there in prison that reading had changed forever the course of my life. As I see it today, the ability to read awoke inside me some long, dormant craving to be mentally alive. I certainly wasn't seeking any degree, the way a college confers a status symbol upon its students. My homemade education gave me, with every additional book that I read, a little bit more sensitivity to the deafness, dumbness, and blindness that was afflicting the black race in America. Not long ago, an English writer telephoned me from London, asking questions. One was, "What's your alma mater?" I told him, "Books." You will never catch me with a free 15 minutes in which I'm not studying something I feel might be able to help the black man.